Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is Sydney Wildsmith, and you're listening to the Wild Side News. In a moment, we're going to explore what's happening to the once ancient American chestnut forests, which covered vast stretches of the American East. We will talk with the president and CEO of the American Chestnut Foundation, Marshall Cates, whose mission it is to restore 4 billion American chestnut trees to the eastern forest ecosystems. Keep on track. We'll be right back with more of the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is Sydney Wildsmith, and welcome back to the Wild Side News. Well, in this segment, we've got an amazing guy that we're going to be talking to, and a very close personal friend of mine. This is Marshall Cates. He is in Bennington, Vermont, where he is the CEO and president of the American Chestnut Foundation. Marshall and I have quite a long history, and I'm just going to share one very personal thing. A while ago, I was writing a postcard as part of an art bio for myself, and I wrote specific postcards to the people who had great influence in my life, and I wrote one to Marshall, and I'm going to share this. Now, I wrote this, it's a little postcard, it says, to Marshall Cates, Senior Vice President, Director of Education, National Audubon, New York, New York, and it says, Dear Marshall, you come from east, I come from west of you, I gathered stones, you songs of birds, I lifted rocks, you poked with sticks. We met a long path later, you like a dazzling agate, me like a glistening frog. The earth creates new brothers of stones and common feathers, and mortared like no others, torn from the chest of God. Well, I meant every word of that. Marshall, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you, Sydney. Good to hear you again.
It is good to talk with you. Marshall, why don't you fill people in a little bit about your history? Because, boy, you are one amazing guy as a birder, as a builder of museums, as a nature educator, and now working with the American Chestnut Foundation. Why don't you give us a little background about you?
Well, I've been interested in the natural world since I was very little, like I guess you were. You know, sometimes you just start out that way, and for me it's been all of my life, my whole career, and my personal interests. Actually, I was, before going to school, into elementary school, I was kicking around near the base of the Great Smoky Mountains when my father was stationed down at Oak Ridge in Tennessee. And I remember, you know, 4 or 5 years old, before they moved up to the Philadelphia area, that there were a lot of neat things up in the streams. That's back when the roads weren't quite the way they are now through the Smokies. We'd take a picnic lunch up into the mountains, and the black bears would be crawling over the top of the car and, you know, trying to get at your cookies on the back shelf of the old 39. You know, it was one of the Ford products, as I remember, old gray car. And I still have those memories. Once we got to Philadelphia, things changed quite a bit because we were in the suburban area, and I didn't have the wide open spaces that I had experienced in Tennessee. But my favorite spot was where the four neighbors' yards came together at a corner. Nobody quite knew where the corner marker was. And it kind of grew up into a bramble. And I built a little pond back there and, you know, had my toads and fish and things like that. And there used to be a lot of birds that would come through, catbirds and thrashers and lots of interesting things. There weren't many books then. But I really, I just enjoyed it. And it's been that way all my life. So I went on to Cornell. They had a good program, and I was able to go through that and get wildlife and conservation education combination in my, you know, in my curriculum program. And then it's just, you know, the rest of it's history, as they say. I was lucky to get a job with the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History when I graduated, and actually built a museum there with two other guys. We didn't raise enough money to have somebody be a contractor, so we said, okay, we can do that. took us 2 years, but I was doing programs in the meantime around the Cape, working with the different schools, and it was just a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. And the rest of the time has been pretty much focused on building nature centers and then getting to work into a pretty much of a global scene. I've been to Russia about 20 times, as you know, and worked with Russian film crews on a program called World of Animals, which before the breakup of the Soviet Union had a little over 200 million viewers each Saturday when they air it. I think now it's still around 150, 160 million people that watch that program. So that was fun. That kind of broadened my horizons. Also made me realize that resolving things in the United States was not going to cure the world problems. I was a little bit naive, I think. So I put a good effort there in Central and South America as well. I've worked with what they call neotropical migrant birds, which you know are birds that go among the Americas, Canada, and the United States. Actually, we borrow them. They come from rainforests and points south of where I am here in Vermont. And they spend the late spring, summer, early fall up this way just as a place to get food and raise their young. And I've just watched these things unfold over the years, and I still am in love with the land, and I have my own 92-acre farm now. It's no buildings on it. That's the real blessing. It's just all meadows and a wet forest and a sugar bush, and I've set it up for protection of neotropical migrant birds. I've actually logged 103 species already just in the last 2 years, and I don't spend a whole lot of time outside, so... it's just sort of a quick career path. It's been a lot of fun. I'm always going to be interested in this. It's still, I guess, in my heart and soul. I just feel a real connection to the land, and it's hard for me when I see it disappear and critters go with it because they lose their space. So I fight as best I can to educate people and, you know, work with others who are doing similar things to see if we can't at least stabilize the situation and maybe even begin to heal it.
Well, your current work right now certainly is involved with restoration and stabilizing and recreating ecosystems, and this is with the American Chestnut Foundation. Tell us about the mission and how you guys are working these days.
Well, the mission is very simple. It's to restore the American chestnut to the eastern forest ecosystem. It sounds simple, but as I think you mentioned, there were 4 billion trees lost, so that's 4 billion as in D. And it was about 25% of the eastern forest mix, and it was from Maine to Georgia, even some records down to the panhandle of Florida. But essentially, it was from Maine to, say, northern Georgia. And it went west of the Mississippi, but on an erratic line. You couldn't draw a line right up the eastern side of the Mississippi River, but it did go as far west as southeastern Ohio. It went to Memphis, Tennessee, some down into northern Alabama. These trees were remarkable. They were unscathed for a long, long, long time, thousands of years, and then this blight, it's a fungus, was brought in by accident through the nursery stock before we had quarantine laws. And it was first discovered in New York City area, and it raced it from the time that it was discovered. It had probably been around for 4 or 5 years. It was actually discovered in 1904, 1905, and it was so effective, the fungus was so effective in its movement that it was moving at about 50 miles a year out from New York. So by the time we got to the early 1950s, most all the trees were either dead or dying of the blight. And just to give people a kind of try to visualize what these trees were like, they jumped up to the top of the canopy, and some of them reached 120 feet in height. It was common to have trees that were 6, 8, 10 feet in diameter, in groves even, not just a tree here and a tree there, but you know, actual groves of them. And down in western North Carolina, we have one tree, one historic record, and even the outer ring of this tree from documentation some years ago, that was 17 feet in diameter, not circumference, 17 feet in diameter. And And it was called the redwood of the East because these trees had a lot of tannin in them. And, of course, they grew tall. They were big in diameter, and they lasted. Some of them we know were at least 400 years old. They also were rot resistant. So when it came to people making use of them, it was called a cradle-to-grave tree because you could rock your child in it, made from chestnut, and you could also bury your family members in it because it would stay a long time in the ground, just a good wood. And people would build entire cabins and homes from it, from the sills, you know, right up to the carrying beams and the roof shingles. It also had huge wildlife implications. On average, the mast crop, the crop of nuts every year in the eastern forest, if you were to collect all the nuts in a designated area and then count them up, over 50% of the nuts on average would have been American chestnut. So that's including, you know, oak and walnuts and butternut and everything else, and you collected all the nuts, over 50% was chestnut on average. So it was a real boon to wildlife, bears, turkeys, deer, squirrels, you know, and right into the food chain. It also provided a cash crop, particularly for the Appalachian families, from Pennsylvania in particular down to Georgia. And we have, we collect memories, stories from people who still remember or participated in something connected to chestnut when they were alive. And those folks are up in their 80s and 90s now for the most part. And, you know, we know that families that live, say, in the mountains of the Smokies, western North Carolina, they had no money. They had no cash. So what they would do is they would have a subsistence living, which was heavily dependent on chestnut because of the, you know, the food value, the using the lumber and fattening up their hogs, and also because it provided a lot of food for wildlife. There's a lot of game to hunt. And then when they needed cash, they would go during the holidays, Thanksgiving to Christmas time, over to Knoxville, Tennessee in this case, and they would exchange bags of chestnuts for shoes for their kids. And that would be the only pair of shoes those kids would get for a year. So it actually provided an entire lifestyle for many of these people. So when the chestnut disappeared, and nobody, of course, knew this was going to happen, there's no preparation, there's no way to stop the fungus either, it really had a dramatic impact on particularly the mountain families. The whole communities were hit very hard by this. The good news is that we're developing a blight-resistant tree. In fact, we're well on our way. We've been working on this for about 15 years. The organization was founded 20 years ago. This is our 20th anniversary. And mainly all on volunteer power to start with. In fact, it was all on volunteers. And now we're about 5,100 strong in terms of membership. We're really jumping up in numbers. We have 10 state chapters with three more in the works. And this is building a great base of support for us so that we can get small orchards going up and down the in the eastern area, and then eventually the best trees will be used for the seed orchards from which we will begin the reforestation program. But we're doing a lot of side things. The coal industry now is very interested in what we do because of the potential for mine land reclamation. Chestnut does real well in clear cuts. It likes acidic soil, and it's just a real competitor. It always could outcompete the other hardwood species in the past. And we're also getting interest from the utilities because of what they call carbon sequestration. So chestnut, because of being an aggressive species and it can expand rapidly in numbers, it can help with this whole carbon problem that we have.
Marshall, if people wanted to visit a mature chestnut forest, where could they go in America these days?
Well, there really isn't one. We've had meetings occasionally up in Wisconsin, up in the neck of woods where you came from or grew up. And western Wisconsin, there's a stand. It's the only self-generating stand of American chestnut, but it's on private property. And we have had annual meetings there. Of course, if people go to our website, they can at least get images of these. We have both ones from the past as well as some of the ones we work with now. But there just aren't any. That's the problem. There are sprouts that come up, in the woods, the fungus did not affect the root system. It attacked everything above ground, but it's out, you know, the blight's out there, the fungus is out there. So as soon as new shoots come up within a couple, 3 years, or when they reach 15 to 20 feet in height within, say, 5 to 6 years, and before they begin to bloom, where they can begin to pollinate again, the blight gets them and they're knocked back. There are some what we call large survivors, and we actually have a search for these. We have found some. These are trees that escape the blight for some reason. There are very few of them, but they escape the blight. Maybe they were tucked into a sugar bush. We have one here in Vermont. That's why I'm saying that. Or they got the blight, and for some reason they're hanging on. And of course, we're interested in those trees because they may have some natural resistance.
Well, Marshall, I'm going to. We have about 45 seconds left
yep.
here, and so why don't you tell people for sure how they can learn a lot more about the American Chestnut Foundation?
Well, the best way is to go to our website. It's ACF for American Chestnut Foundation, so acf.org, O-R-G, and they'll find more than enough there, and they're welcome to take the numbers and the address that we have and write on in and ask us questions, or they can sign up. Actually, we have a discounted rate. They sign up as a member right on our website.
Well, that sounds great. Marshall, thanks so much for sharing your work and your passion. We'll meet again and talk. This is Sidney Wildsmith with the Wildside News. You're listening to the Wildside News Show, the worldwide leader in Internet talk.